as well as finance. And the board of optometry, I give them this little spiel. Here's how it works. It was fun. They flew me
Please
out to
rise.
Boston for a conference.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Schmidt, Judge Johnson, Judge Larkin. The Honorable John Schmidt presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is March 12th, and we have three cases on for argument. We've heard one already, and we have one non-argument calendar. So, both counsel, I think you are very familiar with the rules here. There's buttons below the podium that can adjust it up and down. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please be sure to state your name for the record because this will be recorded. And I'll ask the marshal to go ahead and call this case.
Now calling A240799, State of Minnesota versus Kevin Herman Larson.
All right, and counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jessica Gaddis, and I represent the appellant, Kevin Larson. I requested argument for one specific reason, and that is that this case involves Kevin Larson. The natural reaction when we look at this case is to think, here we go again. It's Kevin Larson. He's never registered. He never will. He's obviously guilty. Indeed, that seems to be the sum total of the state's argument in this case. But precisely because we think we know Mr. Larson so well, it's important that we take a pause and challenge ourselves to look critically at the state's prosecution in this particular case. Because while this is a sufficiency challenge, this case is really about how the state charged it. Now, importantly, in Larson 9, the Minnesota Supreme Court established what the state needs to do when, as in this case, it seeks to prosecute him for failing to register with his correction agent before being released from prison. Given the state's evidence and theory of the case, it should have, following Larson 9, charged him with a violation of subdivision 3, paren A. But the state did not charge Mr. Larson that way. Instead, the state charged Mr. Larson with violating the registration statute in three other ways. Subdivision 3, paren B, subdivision 3A, paren B, and an unidentified, non-existent subdivision purportedly requiring him to sign the BCA forms admitted at trial as Exhibit 4. Because of how the state chose to charge Mr. Larson in this case, it required itself to prove something more than simply that he refused to register with his correction agent before being released from prison. Instead, the state had to prove additional and different elements as detailed in appellant's brief. And because the state failed to prove those additional and different elements, the state's evidence in this case is insufficient to support Mr. Larson's conviction. Quite simply, Your Honors, the state failed to prove the case the way it chose to charge it. And for that reason, Mr. Larson's convictions must be reversed. The one additional point that I'd like to make sure, or hope to make sure, that the court is clear on is that when we are talking about the third theory that the state presented in this case, the requiring Mr. Larson's signature on the predatory offender registration forms, what I want to be clear about and have this court be clear about is that what we're talking about here is specifically Exhibit 4 introduced at trial in the addendum to appellant's brief. That's a packet of BCA forms. It's those forms that we're talking about when we make the argument here that the state's evidence is insufficient, because there is nothing in the registration statute that requires Mr. Larson to complete and sign those forms. This court has recognized as much. In Larson 8, that was an issue, and this court recognized in Larson 8 that Mr. Larson may fulfill his duty to register by signing any document that contains the information requested by the statute. So I want to be clear that it's not just, as respondent briefs suggests, about his signature alone. It's about this packet of forms. It's about the state's theory in this case that this Exhibit 4, this particular pack of BCA forms, is what he was required to complete and sign, and that in failing to do so, he violated the statute. And that is simply not true.
I'm curious about the procedural history, and I guess the complaint refers simply to section .166. And then there was an instructions conference where it was clarified by defense counsel. I think defense counsel requested the inclusion of language reflecting 3B and 3AB. It seems like, before the instructions conference, was there a draft provided to counsel that included the first bullet point about the forms? Do you know?
I don't know off the top of my head, Your Honor, if you're asking about a draft of the jury instructions.
Right.
Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
You know, honestly, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I'm not sure about that. What I do recall from the procedural history is that the parties all seem to be proceeding under this idea that, as they described it, the signature on predatory offender registration forms was a requirement. And that's why that language made it into the jury instructions in this case.
I have questions about whether that is a third theory or a third charge, or whether it is a requirement superimposed on the two theories that are set out in more detail. You seem to, in other words, I mean, but for your argument, I might construe it otherwise, but you're coming to us, I guess, telling us that there's three legal bases of the verdict, and that, and you've challenged all three, and so that seems to be undisputed. So
right.
you want us to interpret it that way.
Right, and the reason I have addressed the argument that way in the briefing is because I'm simply just following how the case was prosecuted and charged. So when you look at the jury instructions as quoted in my brief, or if you look directly at the transcript, you'll see that when the court is instructing on the, I believe it's the third element of the offense, that he knowingly violated a registration requirement, the court then goes on to delineate and separate three specific requirements that it's alleged that he's violated. And then similarly,
can I stop you on
that? Oh, sure.
Because looking at the transcript, I mean, the way it was spoken by the judge, apparently, I don't know if they're delineated. I mean, it's a lot of words run together and not with the same line breaks that I see in the printed instructions, which I believe were submitted to the jury. In this situation, you know, how or where do we discern the instructions given? In other words, where do we look? Do we look at both the transcript and the printed instructions, or one or the other?
Well, I guess, Your Honor, I would say it's probably a distinction without a difference in terms of how you want to look at them on the printed page, because there's really no dispute in this case among the parties that these were three distinct theories that the state brought forward. And I've pointed you in my briefing to the prosecutor's closing argument, where where the prosecutor specifically and repeatedly talked to the jury about a violation here being that Mr. Larson failed to complete and sign the BCA packet introduced as Exhibit 4. So the state relied specifically and repeatedly on that as an isolated basis for the jury to convict.
And those three theories were not divided out on the verdict form. Is that right?
If you're asking, did they have like a special verdict form that asked a question? No, they did not. No, and the argument was simply that these are three alternative requirements that he had under the registration statute, and the prosecutor specifically argued that the jury did not have to find all three. It could find any one, and that would constitute a violation.
The theory aligning with subdivision 3A paren B and paren, I think that's your second subpart of the first part of your brief. It seems like the argument there is fairly similar to an argument made by Mr. Larson in Larson 5, an opinion of the court issued in 2019. I was the author. And when I look at that, I mean, I think the reasoning there was that even though there was no evidence by the state specifically relating to a police chief or the other identified law enforcement authority, we have sort of overarching evidence that Mr. Larson never registered anywhere. There's no, you know, there he never signed a document, and therefore evidence is sufficient. So it seems like if we were to follow that reasoning again, we would reach the same result. But how would you urge us to analyze that issue?
So I have two answers for Your Honor on that point. The first is that I think it is important that we remember and keep in mind when we're deciding this case that our framework now for understanding Mr. Larson's series of prosecutions, I think, is clarified by the Supreme Court's decision in Mr. Larson's most previous appeal prior to this one, because that decision analyzed what is the correct unit of prosecution that we're looking at. We need to be sure that we are not re-prosecuting Mr. Larson for that initial failure to register, and that we are looking at what are his requirements now in light of his prior prosecutions, what was triggering his newest duty to register, and what is he being prosecuted for. So I think that's a starting point. Then more specifically, to go to Your Honor's question, with respect to the subdivision 3A paren B, the release from correctional facility issue, there's two important things that are in play in what the state has to prove that subdivision. Your Honor has touched on one of them, what I call the who of that provision, which is who is the duty to register with. The second one is what I call the what of that provision. And the what is the fact that Mr. Larson does not have a new primary address. That's actually something that the state has to prove if they're going to charge and convict him under this subdivision. That follows directly from this court's published decision in Nelson, cited in my brief, where the corollary provision in that one was the new primary address subdivision. And this court held that one of the facts the state has to prove to secure a conviction under that subdivision is that the registrant had a new primary address. So following from that logic, from that plain reading of the statute, an important fact here that the state failed to prove is that Mr. Larson did not have a new primary address. In addition to the who, and it's our argument that the who in this subdivision matters. He is not required under this to secure a conviction under this subdivision. It doesn't matter that he didn't tell his correction agent this information. He's not required to under this subdivision. When the state chose to charge this subdivision, they put upon themselves the burden of proving that Mr. Larson failed to give the information to the law enforcement authority that had jurisdiction where Mr. Larson would be staying. So because of how the state charged it, that's what they had to prove, and that's what they failed to prove.
So we're talking about the second theory in isolation, but it seems like the two theories that are based on the subdivisions, I mean, they're mutually exclusive. Either he has a new primary address or he doesn't. And so, I mean, either way, I don't know. You've mentioned the circumstantial evidence standard of review, but are you encouraging us to find that the predicate of either has or doesn't have is not satisfied in for both of those theories?
That's correct, Your Honor. So in either case, and I understand how logically it would seem to maybe make sense that the state would charge these alternate theories, because at first blush, it does seem like, well, either a person does or does not have an address. But it's not that simple. When we're looking at the sufficiency of the evidence in that context, what we know from Nelson is that a fact that has to be proven if you're going to charge under subdivision 3 paren B is that he have a new primary address. That actually has to be proven. So if the state chose to charge it that way, they have to prove it. Now remember, this is not, and this takes me back to where I started. I think that Larson 9 gives you the template of the thing that seems to make the most sense for the state to do when they're charging Mr. Larson is to charge under subdivision 3 paren A, because that's the requirement that simply talks about his duty to register with his correction agent as soon as the agent is assigned. So if the state had charged Mr. Larson that way in this case, then we don't need to worry about this address. Does he have one? Does he not? Because that would not be a fact that the state would have to prove had they charged him under subdivision 3 paren A. All that that requires the state to prove is that he failed to register with his assigned correction agent when that agent was assigned. So this court has made clear in reviewing Mr. Larson's prosecutions over the years that the subdivision matters. This is a very subdivision-specific inquiry when we're looking at the sufficiency of the evidence to support a conviction under the failure to register statute. So for that reason, because of the way the state charged this case, because of the additional and specific facts it put upon itself, they had to prove it, and they simply didn't. And for that reason, we are asking this court to reverse Mr. Larson's conviction. Thank you.
You'll have 5 minutes for your rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, when you're ready, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Sean McCarthy. I'm an assistant Rice County attorney. I appear today on behalf of respondent, the state of Minnesota. I'd like to pick up on a point that Judge Johnson, you raised, which is the two specifically charged subdivision, 3B and 3A parens B, that there's an overarching piece of that. And that's the part that hasn't yet been brought up. We also have 243.166 subdivisions 4 and 4C, which make it clear that whatever kind of registration you do, the registration must be in writing and must be signed by the person. To interpret these statutes any other way would be to invalidate subdivision 4 and subdivision 4C. Indeed, 4C even adds some additional clarification here of what the legislature intended. All notices required by this section must be in writing and signed by the person. A categorical refusal to sign anything or do anything, again, in response to Judge Johnson's question about, you know, these seem to be logically inconsistent, I think was what appellant's counsel was saying. A categorical refusal to do anything or sign anything, I would submit that that fits when you read subs 4 and 4C together with the charged offenses of 3B and 3A parens B. The conduct here is such that that's enough to meet the sufficiency of the evidence, and the jury instructions given are an accurate statement of the law.
What about the first? There's three bullet points under the third, or maybe there's kind of bullets and sub-bullets, but the first of three talks about, I'm looking for it now.
Is the court referring to the actual jury instructions?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, page 7 of 10 from the jury instructions, and I think those are appellant's addendum, if I recall.
The first bullet, just a clause that says signature on predatory offender registration forms. Is that by itself a violation of the statute?
On these facts, with the extreme conduct, the refusal by conduct of refusing to sign anything, I think there's room to argue that that is not a violation because it accurately states in the context of this offense and this person's conduct. I think a more artful way that fits the statute more cleanly would have been to say signature on required notification or something along those lines, a more generic form, to recognize, as this court has done in the past, that it doesn't have to be a specific form, but it does have to be in writing and signed by the person.
And in that case, that requirement would not be an independent requirement, but it would be a condition or qualification of the second and third bullet point.
Exactly, which was the question Your Honor raised earlier. It's subs 4 and 4C help clarify what's required by subs 3B and 3AB.
So I guess my the point I'm getting to is, isn't the jury instruction erroneous by appearing to state an independent requirement that solely consists of signing registration forms?
On its face, it appears as such, but again, it's a two-part question for this court to review. This is an unobjected to jury instruction, and the second part, the second step of analysis is, on these facts, did this particular instruction rise to the level of, you know, appellant's heavy burden to show that the instruction had an effect on the verdict? On a case like this, where the evidence is he wouldn't sign anything, he didn't do anything, he didn't even acknowledge the guy was in the room, he ignored him the whole time. That's on the final day, the December 27th. On those facts, how does it matter whether they said predatory offender registration forms, and there's an exhibit 4 that gives an example of that, when there's absolutely nothing in the record to suggest he signed anything? Otherwise, we're assuming, oh, there might have been some other form, and hypothetically, he might have, you know, written something on paper by himself. That's not in our record. Therefore, you never meet that second prong. Does that answer the court's question?
I think so.
I think your opposing counsel's argument, though, is if the jury convicted by saying you didn't sign the predatory registration form, and that was the reason they convicted, now we're into Khalil, where you have a inappropriate verdict and potentially a valid verdict. And under the Supreme Court, they said that's a new trial. So how do we deal with that?
I will acknowledge, Your Honor, you've nailed a piece here that I don't have a good answer for. The resolution of a possible inconsistent verdict like this due to an instruction is a new trial, if that is the route the court chooses to go. I think one thing that I would ask this panel to consider before you jump, it's easy, you know, here I'm conceding that that's a valid point. On this case, again, with the larger, let's call it the statutory scheme, and factoring in subdivisions 4 and 4C, which make it expressly clear, you gotta sign something. You gotta do it in writing. And there's nothing in the record suggesting he ever signed anything or ever did it in writing. The concept that comes to mind, again, in answer to the court's questions here, it's akin to DWI law. We have refusal by conduct. You're asked a question, you have to test or not test. In predatory registration, it's very similar. You have to register. You either do or you don't. And to not register, to ignore the person there, to refuse to sign the forms, that's a refusal by conduct. That's a court-created concept. It's the closest analogy I can think of. There's room for this panel to explore clarifying this fairly comprehensive and complicated scheme by pointing out that a refusal, especially when you factor in subs 4 and 4C together with the other subdivisions, your refusal to sign and do in writing the registration requirements is in fact a refusal. I offer that as at least something I'd ask the panel to chew on. I think that there's room to develop the law a little bit on this point. But I also acknowledge, as Judge Schmidt, you just asked, there is the potential here for what looks like an inconsistent or improper verdict of some sorts, and the remedy would be to remand for a new trial. Unless the panel has other questions, those were the key points I wanted to get across.
I'm not seeing any, so thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. So there's just 2 points I'd like to make. First, I heard opposing counsel talk to you in terms of the sufficiency argument about Mr. Larson's, I believe I wrote this correctly, his categorical refusal to do anything. Again, Your Honors, I cannot emphasize enough that that being the state's theory of the case and that being what they want to prosecute him for, that required them to charge him under Subdivision 3, Paren A, because that's the provision that recognizes that he has a duty to register with his assigned correction agent when that person is assigned. That broad duty to register of all of the information that the statute requires a registrant to provide. So if we're talking about his wanting to prosecute him for his refusal to provide the information that the registration statute requires him to provide, charge it, as the state has done previously, under Subdivision 3, Paren A. Not what they did here. Because of that, they had to prove more, and they failed to prove the additional and different elements that their own charging decision required them to prove in this case.
Could you please summarize again the additional elements of proof that are absent, that are not
so,
proved?
Sure. So the additional would be...
And perhaps... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's okay. So with respect to subdivision... Let me grab my book. I'm going to make sure I get the statutes right, sites right. With respect to subdivision 3B, that's the new primary address. So the additional and different element there is specifically the proof of what that he had a new primary address. Okay.
And I think that's in your brief, that was your only argument with respect to that theory. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. Because that particular subdivision does talk about the duty to provide that information to the assigned corrections agent.
And I think Nelson is good authority.
Correct.
On that point. And moving to the next theory then.
Yep. So 3A paren B is the release from correctional facility provision. The different thing there is that does not require him to register the information with the corrections agent. That is the who of that one is the law enforcement authority in the jurisdiction where he'll be staying. And the what in that one is that he does not have a new primary address. So those are the specific facts that they have to prove to obtain a conviction under that subdivision.
And the evidence is insufficient to prove which item or items?
Both. The lack of a new primary address and the failure to provide the required information to the law enforcement authority. And then the second point that I wanted to make, piggyback on Your Honor's question about the different and additional elements of proof here. What I'm hearing now is a pivot by the state to suggest that this argument at trial about how Mr. Larson's signature on the Exhibit 4 was required is somehow a gloss to the other two specifically charged subdivisions. I really encourage this court to pay close attention to how this case was prosecuted and argued. The prosecutor at trial made abundantly clear that the state believed that a standalone basis for convicting Mr. Larson of a violation was that he did not complete and sign the documents that were submitted as Exhibit Number 4. That is a BCA packet that is created for an initial registrant. It's in the addendum, and again, as you'll see, and as you've already ruled in what I'm calling Larson 8, that document, that packet of information is not anything the registration statute requires him to complete. So please understand, and please don't be confused about this idea of all the state was trying to suggest was he had to give this give required information in writing and sign it. No. At trial, the state was very clear, and the jury was specifically instructed that a standalone basis for convicting him was his failure to complete that BCA form that he is not required to complete.
If we're doing a substantial rights analysis and let's say we're kind of playing out a hypothetical. Let's say if we assume that the jury first considered the first bullet point, he didn't sign the forms, guilty. Now, I think, tell me, and this is where I'm, please tell me if you think I'm wrong. I mean, I think our analysis about affecting substantial rights either requires us or allows us to play out a hypothetical where if that erroneous paragraph were not there, the jury would have continued to the second and third bullet points under the third requirement and considered then the other two theories. And if we believe that the jury would have nonetheless then returned a guilty verdict on those theories, then wouldn't we conclude that his substantial rights were not affected?
So I see my time is up, so I will try and be concise with this answer if I may have the additional time.
Yeah, please.
Okay. So in this particular case, I understand where you're coming from. I understand your point. But I would refer you back to the details that I've provided in my brief in the interests of limited time here to look at the prosecutor's argument specifically about why it's actually in this case more likely, based on the prosecutor's argument, that the jury would have simply concluded that he was guilty because he failed to complete that packet and sign that packet of forms. At the very least, I think this is just like Khalil in that it's equally reasonably likely that the jury could have found his guilt on the improper basis as it was. My position in this case, I suppose, is that that the state didn't prove any of these bases, but assuming we're beyond the sufficiency and we're just looking at the jury instruction issue, it's certainly equally likely that the jury could have decided on the improper basis as the proper basis, just like Khalil. You have no way to know from the verdict forms or from anything else in this case what was the specific basis for the jury's decision.
That if I may, Judge Schmidt, that, I mean, I think the difference is that, if I remember correctly, in Khalil, there was one question presented and one, you know, and the instruction was erroneous in that point. And so, but here there's sort of like backstops, or there's three different layers of theories. And so if, so the jury had other, you know, would have, if it had, to, if the erroneous instruction were not there, it would have proceeded to the next theory. And if it had found not guilty verdict, then that wasn't proved, it would have gone to the third theory and so on. So it seems to me we are, when we play out the scenario, we should consider that, and that makes it different from Khalil.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think it's actually any different than Khalil in that what we're dealing with in both cases is that the jury was instructed about alternate theories for finding guilt, and one of the alternate theories that was specifically presented to the jury was absolutely incorrect. It was not a basis for finding guilt. And so since we have a verdict form that does not require the jury to specify which theory they chose, and because it was equally likely that they could have relied on the clearly improper theory as opposed to the proper theory, that's why Khalil was decided the way it was, and that's why it should be decided that same way in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you for the arguments and the briefs that you submitted. We will get an opinion out within the statutory time frame.